You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, as part of his state budget vetoes, Governor Evers blocked funding for a proposed mental health crisis center in northern Wisconsin. Assembly Republicans tried to override that veto last week but came up short. Our guest lawmaker tells us why the facility is needed and how communities are getting by in the meantime. Right now, it's time for our weekly state news roundup. First, a Lafayette County committee this week brought forth a proposal to punish its own officials and the press for talking about the results of an ongoing groundwater study in southwestern Wisconsin without prior approval. Hope Kerwin is WPR's reporter based in La Crosse. Hope, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this proposal changed over time. This came out last week before the Lafayette County Land Conservation Committee became public. What did the original version say?
So the original version would have limited any future test results coming out of the Southwest Wisconsin groundwater and geology study to just the chairs of the county boards in Iowa, Grant, Lafayette County, and the county conservationists. Those individuals would then be craft what was described as an appropriate statement, and which the press would have been required to print in its entirety, and it even said violators of that would be prosecuted.
So violators meaning either, say, county board members or members of the press who didn't observe those conditions could be prosecuted?
Well, this one line about prosecuted really seemed to be aimed at the press who did not print the statement in its entirety and who maybe used it for what was described as gleaning information or selectively reporting the results.
Now, what is going on with groundwater there that there are these studies that have reached this point of controversy?
So the SWIG study is a kind of a widespread testing of private wells in these three counties, Grant, Iowa, and Lafayette, to look at contamination issues and kind of understand what's causing contamination issues in these private wells. And what's kind of appeared to be at behind this resolution, although we don't know the author of the resolution, that has never come out, so it's hard to know exactly what's behind it, but really the conversation has centered around some reporting on testing results that took place this summer. It was a round of testing. Researchers retested wells that had previously been shown to have contamination to better understand what was going on there. And unfortunately, some of that reporting said that 91% of wells tested in southwestern Wisconsin were contaminated. Well, that statistic was true, but it didn't have the context that was needed to understand that these wells were tested specifically because they had previously been shown to have contamination and were therefore not a representative of the entire region.
Now, the resolution itself has gone through a bit of a roller coaster since it went public. What's happened since the public saw it until now?
Indeed, yeah. When it was first released on the county's website, there was a lot of reaction, negative reaction, both from some members of the county board themselves to the press, to members of the public. When I spoke on Friday with the county's corporation counsel, an attorney that advises the county board, he advised me that the resolution was not going to be considered by the board. But by Monday evening, then I was alerted that the committee was going ahead with considering the resolution. What ended up being considered at that meeting on Tuesday morning of this week was actually a revised version of this resolution that did not call for prosecuting the press, but did call for restricting who county officials or county board members could talk about this study. And then by the time the full county board met Tuesday evening, because of all of the pushback, it ended up getting tabled and the county board did not take action on it.
As we wrap up, Hope, is there a thought that it could come back in future meetings?
That's unknown. There's a lot unknown about this resolution, but I think people will definitely be paying attention to see if it does.
Hope, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Hope Kerwin is a WPR reporter based in La Crosse. She talked with us about a proposal in Lafayette County that would punish some county officials for talking with the media about the results of an ongoing groundwater study. Now, Wausau is responding to complaints over homeless people spending time in its parking ramps with a pair of new city ordinances. Natalie Brophy is the urgency reporter for the Wausau Daily Herald. Natalie, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, the city council passed these ordinances on Tuesday. What changes under these ordinances?
So in city parking ramps in metered lots, it's now against the law to be, first of all, trespassing or loitering. So you're only allowed to be in the ramps if you're, you know, parking your vehicle or, you know, coming back to get your car, something like that. And also prohibits consuming or having alcohol in your possession in the city parking ramps and parking lots.
What were the concerns that led to this?
So it was brought up at an October committee meeting that there were complaints from citizens, from downtown business employees and business owners that there were homeless people either sleeping in the heated stairwells or just, you know, hanging out in there trying to stay warm. So that is, I guess, how the ordinance came to be and how it was kind of presented at first is because of this problem. And, you know, there were people relieving themselves in the parking ramps and engaging in sexual activity.
And what were some of the criticisms of this change as it was going through?
Yeah, there are a lot of, you know, concern from residents and from some, you know, people on the city council that they would basically be kicking out people who are just trying to find a warm place to stay, especially, you know, during the winters here in Wisconsin, it can get very, very cold.
Are there initiatives underway in Wausau to cut down on homelessness or to provide housing that isn't a parking ramp, say?
Yes. The police chief, Ben Bliven, he has said that he is working to start kind of a roundtable, a kind of action group to address this problem, and that the ordinance is kind of, you know, a good, you know, a way that showed leaders that this is an issue that our community really cares about and is interested in, you know, finding solutions.
Natalie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
That's Natalie Brophy with the Wausau Daily Herald. She talked with us about a new ordinance in Wausau that would prohibit loitering and drinking in the city's parking ramps. Now, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett and the City Council have signed off on a project to build a village of tiny homes on the city's northwest side meant to help homeless veterans. Alana Watson is WPR's Second Century News Fellow. Alana, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Can you describe, for starters, the plans for this village of tiny houses for homeless veterans?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Milwaukee Village, it will be very similar to the project that's currently in Racine that opened in 2017. It's going to be slightly bigger, though. So there will be 48 tiny homes, and they'll be 240 square feet. And then they'll also have a 10,000 square foot community center, and that will have a kitchen, like a recreational area, showers, a laundry room. And that center will be where veterans will participate in different programs like helping with PTSD, searching for jobs, finding benefits, and housing placement. And then they'll also have different classes like wellness classes. So yoga, cooking, art, things like that, that'll kind of help them help socialize with each other.
You talked with the area's alder, Shantia Lewis, who's a veteran herself, I understand, about the project. What did she have to say about the need for it?
Yes, absolutely. So Lewis was the chair of this initiative, and she actually lives in the area where the village will be. And she basically said that she understood how easily it is for veterans to become homeless after serving. She said that, you know, the transition from serving our country into the civilian world is very, very difficult. And that one thing that stood out that she said to me was that after you're done, they're like, thank you, have a good day. And she said that sometimes people just don't understand that. So the Village of Tiny Homes will basically give veterans the opportunity to have a level of freedom and independence, but also be surrounded by like a strong support system.
Is the idea here that this is permanent housing, or is this kind of a step towards something else?
So this is a recovery program. So veterans likely will stay up to 1 to 2 years, basically just trying to get their finances together, find permanent housing, and really just kind of help them get themselves back into the workforce.
Mayor Barrett and the Common Council, it sounds like they've signed off on this. What's the timeline for this actually opening doors?
Well, they're hopeful that they can start construction in the spring. That's when they want to break ground. If the weather permits, they'll be able to get that started. There's no official date on when they will be opening the community center just yet, but they will be looking, doing interviews and taking applications here pretty soon.
Alana, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Not a problem. Thanks.
Alana Watson is WPR's Second Century News Fellow. She talked with us about a village of tiny homes for homeless veterans in Milwaukee. It was approved by the city earlier this week. She finished out our weekly state news roundup. The state budget passed by the legislature called for a $15 million mental health crisis center in northern Wisconsin. But Governor Evers vetoed that provision and redirected the money to a juvenile facility in Madison. Last week, Assembly Republicans tried to override that veto. They needed two-thirds approval, or 66 votes, to send it to the Senate. It wound up falling short, 62-34, along party lines. That doesn't mean the fight is over. Romaine Quinn is a Republican state representative from Cameron and the Majority Caucus vice chair. Representative Quinn, good to have you back on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Before we get to the veto, can you talk about this mental health crisis center that you had hoped to fund in the state budget this year?
Yeah, as you know, mental health is a piece that we all need to work on. We know we need to do a better job. Nobody disagrees with that. And we are at a point where we really kind of neglected this. And I'm glad the focus has been on mental health for all ages. So this started with Senator Bernier. She took the bull by the horns and said, we are getting something in our area. We are tired of our officers driving across the state, transporting people in crisis. We need something somewhat local. And so after a lot of legwork, she managed to get that provision in the budget. And again, this would serve both youth and adults who are being Chapter 51, as people would call it, who are in a point of crisis. And so right now when this happens, usually the few beds we have in Northwest Wisconsin are full. So our officers, many times after working a full shift, are driving 5, 6, 7, 8 hours one way with a patient in the back of their car, you know, after working a full shift, trying to get them the help they need because we all care about these people. So the idea, again, how can we get a place close? St. Joseph's is willing to do this. You know, we had the money set aside, and unfortunately, it was vetoed out, and that's what we're talking about today.
What was your reaction when you saw that Governor Evers had vetoed this provision?
Well, it seemed to be a pattern because it wasn't just this either, right? He vetoed telehealth funding. Who does that help? Rural Wisconsin. He vetoed the increases for road infrastructure, put it back in a new grant program, changed the parameters, make it harder for the most rural towns to apply. And now we've seen this. And so for me, it just feels like a shot across the bow that there's just a disregard or lack of understanding that the need is so great. And further conversations with Senator Bernier in the governor's office revealed that I don't think they even realize the extent of the amount of people being shipped across the state in crisis. It's over 700 people a year reach a point of crisis in the 28 counties we're trying to serve in Northwest Wisconsin. So it's a huge need, and it's unfortunate that that happened.
The $15 million under the governor's veto would go to the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center in Madison, and that's where some inmates of the Lincoln Hills School for Boys would be transferred to once that youth prison is closed. And that's something that people in both parties have been working for. Is this just a case of urgency and priorities rather than, as you say, a shot across the bow?
Well, I mean, we are still moving in that direction. If you recall, there's still $43 million in this budget going to expand Mendota. And then he took 15 from Chippewa Falls and also sent it to Mendota. So, yeah, we need to add on to Mendota for other youth who are in crisis and in those areas. But the point is, we have nothing. We're not talking about building a new facility. We're just trying to get something up here. So it really feels like we were targeted. And it's really unfortunate that we couldn't even get one single Democrat from Northwestern Wisconsin, especially the one whose district it would have fell into, to even vote with us. So this turned very political, which I find unfortunate. And this proposal, too, is supported by police chiefs, DHS directors from Superior to River Falls to Shell Lake and everywhere in between. We know this isn't a solve-all, but we need to start catching these people who are in crisis and keep them closer to home to get the support they need.
Talking to Republican State Representative Romaine Quinn, Majority Caucus Vice Chair, about funding that had been in the legislature's budget for a mental health crisis center in northern Wisconsin. Governor Evers vetoed that funding. Do you see a chance to start from scratch outside the budget process and try to still make this happen now that the veto override effort fell short?
Yes, we've also reintroduced legislation to do the same exact thing, to expand beds in the Chippewa Falls and Eau Claire area. And again, just to be clear, I don't represent Chippewa Falls or Eau Claire, but I understand that it's closer for many people. It's closer to my district, and it's worth the investment for our officers and the families who are experiencing loved ones in crisis. So this isn't about getting something specifically in my district, but it'll move the ball in the right direction. So we're bringing the legislation back. There's an attempt now to try and push a different bill, basically, in my opinion, trying to cover up for the veto, saying that it's bipartisan. But again, this other legislation spends a third of the money. It splits it five ways and sends it all across the state. So again, not recognizing how big of a need there is in the northwestern part of the state.
Now, because of changes made last month, there could be subsequent override efforts, as I understand it. Would the Assembly try that avenue again, revisiting the idea of overriding this veto?
Well, I mean, if we can build the support, if there's enough public support, and I talk to the representatives, like I said, this should be bipartisan. Police chiefs aren't political. DHS directors aren't political. You know, and if legislators come forward and say, you know, we've heard enough pressure from the public, from our district, to understand the importance of this, you know, I will vote for this, then maybe at that time, but I can't see it coming back up just to have it fail again at this time anyway.
And we've talked in the past about mental health options for people in much of northern Wisconsin. This mental health crisis center, as you mentioned, just one piece of the puzzle. What kind of other efforts would you like to see? What kind of other funding is needed to make sure people have access to care that isn't, again, a 5-6 hour drive?
Yeah, so part of this, we need to get people before they reach the point of crisis. And so we need to do a better job at creating more access for people to get the mental health treatment they need before they reach their breaking point where they're trying to hurt themselves or others. And that was another veto. We had $10 million set aside to specifically raise reimbursement rates for providers who take patients on Medicaid, which is the biggest problem. So in my district, the Cumberland Medical Facility used to have beds for people that would take people from northwestern Wisconsin. They closed that down because they were losing too much money. So we also tried to override that veto. We could not garner any bipartisan support, which, again, was just unfortunate because whether we're trying to address it on the front end or trying to build a facility in Chippewa Falls, it fell along party lines, and it's a shame.
Do you see an opportunity to take some of the politics out of this issue?
I hope so. So we're going to find out, you know, we've heard a lot of excuses why people wanted to uphold the veto. You know, it didn't go through the regular process. I get that, but it's still going back to the building commission, which every project goes through. Some people complain it's a private entity. Yes, we don't want to build a brand new state facility, and we have public-private partnerships all the time. So I think if we can take more time to try and weed through some of these arguments, come back with a separate bill or maybe a veto override later once we get through some of this explaining. But it's unfortunate because I guess you take it for granted, people understanding the need, but it appears we have some more education to do.
I want to switch gears in our last couple minutes. The Assembly passed a resolution this week to call the state's official tree in the Capitol building a Christmas tree. Governor Evers this year announced that it was a holiday tree. Can you explain why this is an issue worth tackling?
And it's unfortunate that we even have to talk about this, because if you hold a picture up with a pine tree with ornaments on it and presents underneath, everyone's going to call it a Christmas tree. So I don't understand how this is even controversial. And unfortunately, it went political. And again, it's one of those things where the governor wants to bring us together. Why even poke the bear on an issue like that when he knows people are going to take it the wrong way? So it's something that, again, we didn't start, but it's pretty clear the tree is a Christmas tree, so we're going to call it a Christmas tree.
Right. The argument is usually holiday would include everyone in the state, including non-Christians. Specifying something as Christmas just appeals to one group. You don't buy it?
Yeah, but it's the Christmas season, right? And it's the birth of Christ, so anyone can celebrate it. That's totally fine. Anyone can celebrate any holiday they want or not celebrate. But the point is, it's the Christmas season. It's the birth of Christ. It's the Christmas tree. So just renaming something doesn't change the meaning behind the holiday. So we don't try to rename symbols of other religions, even if we don't practice them. So why try to rename a Christmas tree?
And in our last few moments, now that budget overrides appear to be done, at least for now, what are your next priorities in the legislature?
Well, for me in particular, it never ends. We're always trying to focus on rural issues. You know, right now the economy is still humming along. We're trying to find more workers, getting people the skills they need to get into better careers, to better the lives of themselves and their families. So that kind of work never ends. And we're always trying to find ways, again, to make state government more efficient as well. So just trying to improve the outcomes in the lives of everyday people that live in all of our districts.
Representative Quinn, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Romaine Quinn, Republican state representative from Cameron and the Majority Caucus vice chair. We talked to them about the assembly's attempt to override Governor Evers' veto of a crisis center, a mental health crisis center in northern Wisconsin. That veto override effort fell short in the legislature. According to a Pew Research Center report, more than half of the Americans polled believed that violent crime has been on the rise over the last decade. But according to crime data, violent crimes have actually declined by nearly 20%. Our next guest believes the way journalists cover crime could be contributing to that public perception. Akintunde Ahmad is a Columbia Journalism Review Delacourt Fellow. He wrote the piece, Why Journalists Need to Think Twice About Reporting on Arrests. Tunde, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be able to speak.
In your piece, you outlined a couple of consequences of the way we cover crime in this country. I want to start with that perception issue we just mentioned. Crime is going down. Our perception is that crime is going up. What is it about the way we cover crime that might be feeding into that as you see it?
Well, I think part of it is that in my reporting process, I talk to a vast array of different breaking news reporters in different cities, and a lot of them stated that their editors told them more or less, if it bleeds, it leads. Or in New York specifically, they say that in order for something to get into the paper, it has to be murder and mayhem. And that's what's guaranteed to be on the breaking news segment. And I think historically, this has just been the way news has functioned. But it really does not have to be that way. I think that we are kind of selling ourselves short and not really thinking about all of the vast arrays of topics that the public finds interesting. And because it's been this way for so long, doesn't necessarily mean that it has to stay that way. And I really do think it's time to make some changes.
There is an argument that, okay, if I live in a community and there's a crime in my community, I want to know about it. Is there a case to be made that journalists are just providing what their audience wants? Or is it more than that?
I think it's a little bit more than that. I think definitely there are some times where if it provides a public threat, then you should definitely inform folks in the area and at large about the perceived or potential danger that they may face due to a crime. But a lot of times it may not be that grave or serious. If we're saying that there was just a bar fight one night from folks who were intoxicated and we list all of their names, they may not be posing a threat to the folks in that area. It was just a one-off incident. However, that stigmatism attached to them committing that crime actually affects their life and future possibilities much more than the good it would do to the public to know that they did that. But in the case of, let's say, someone did discharge with a murder and, you know, the public is searching for them or they're on camera doing a crime and they haven't been convicted of it, but they are charged or a warrant is out for their arrest, I think in those cases, it does make sense to still report it. So, I mean, there's a little bit of gray area there, but I think for the most part, for petty crimes, for petty theft, for, you know, just one-off fights or things like that, it's not necessarily imperative that these outlets do report this and make sure that it's a leading story or always on the breaking news.
You mentioned another, what you see as a negative consequence there. And in your piece, you talk about a documentary on two, I think there were brothers who were accused of a crime. Later, their accuser had recanted. They were exonerated for the crime. But those initial stories were still out there. Can you talk about how that can hang with somebody for their whole lives?
Right. So this documentary out of Omaha followed these two brothers actually over 8 years of their lives. And one of the major turning points in the story was after they had been exonerated of all charges, they realized that in doing a Google search and in their search for employment, they were like just checking their records, and they kept seeing that these articles were still there about this crime that literally on the record, the victim recanted, or the alleged victim recanted and said that she had falsified her report. So there was literally no basis for this to still be out there. And they actually had to call all of these outlets to ask them to take the article down. And some of them did, but some of them didn't. So till this day, if listeners want, they can search Darcell Trotter and they will still find the original piece that was published about him and his brother being charged with his assault that literally never happened and is on record showing that it never happened because the victim recanted. And I mean, it's a common problem and it happens to a lot of folks. And in other countries, you know, they have the right to be forgotten. Like the European Union, you can actually, there's a formal process that you can go through to request that this information be taken down about you. But in the US, it's not the case. So it's really up to the discretion of the editors. And, you know, we're seeing shrinking sizes of newsrooms and massive layoffs. So they have less and less resources to actually devote to actually going back retroactively and making amends to these pieces. So we're trying to figure out a way where we can at least moving forward and potentially retroactively also remove or at least put in a system where people can request to have this information removed.
Talking to Akintunde Ahmad with the Columbia Journalism Review. He wrote a piece there called Why Journalists Need to Think Twice About Reporting on Arrests. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When you're reading or watching news, if it bleeds, should it lead? Do you want to see a lot of crime reporting in your community? Do you think the media over covers crime at the local, state, or national level? Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Tunde, you also write about not just the quantity, but the quality of crime coverage. There's kind of the standard police blotter or crime blotter where it's so-and-so was charged with this crime at this address type of reporting. And there's not really much reporting there.
Yes, definitely. I think a lot of times you get wind of this breaking news either through your local police dispatch, and a lot of folks are stationed at police departments for waiting for this breaking news. And you get to the scene, and oftentimes you have to turn out that piece so quick because this news cycle is recycling so quickly, you know, every 24 hours, but really every hour you want to be the first person, the first news outlet to get this out. So you go with the only available information you have, which is usually from a police officer who was the first responder there, and they may not actually know exactly all the details. They're going on maybe some witness accounts, what a victim of a crime is saying in that moment. But in order to, you know, properly report these things and talk to witnesses and maybe chase down witnesses and get connected with them, you may need more time than that. But a lot of times your news outlet is asking for the information immediately and you have to turn in something quickly. And if all you can go with is just the name and what they're charged with, oftentimes we're missing out on the nuance, on the details that may actually be of a greater service to the public to let them know what actually occurred and avoid some misconceptions and loss of detail in transit.
You give a kind of a worst case example, and I think most reporting doesn't end up like this, but you give an example of some New York tabloid style crime reporting where after that initial police blotter, they kind of have this gruesome, lurid description and blame it on an initial suspect. And then later it turns out they didn't do it at all.
Right. And I mean, this is something that I think can be prevented if reporters are given more time up front to actually do the job of a reporter, which is to track down your sources, to talk to witnesses, to talk to family members, maybe to get a motive on the crime and piece together a story that is cohesive and makes sense with as many sources as possible that are relevant to that particular story, as opposed to potentially endangering someone's future because, right, that stigmatism sticks with you forever because it's not just, oh, they were falsely reported and this article is up, but now if they go to get employment, this is going to stick with them forever. And I think another portion of this that I mentioned when I got to the part about manning the box, which is something in Wisconsin, to my understanding, mm-hmm. you have implemented man the box laws. So, I mean, the whole portion of it is to get rid of the prejudice and stereotype and negative attitude attached to folks who are convicted of crimes and have served their time and have been released. But if you do ban the box, but for most crimes that people end up incarcerated for, there is a media story to go along with it. And there is no way for folks to actually request to these news outlets to remove this information, then it's kind of undercut. You know, we have legislators who are going to battle for these policies, but I'm like, that's only part of the battle because it's all about the perception. And there is no law, of course, banning a potential employer from Googling your name. In fact, I'm assuming that's the first thing that a lot of employers do when they're looking into someone's background. So it seems a bit counterproductive to have all of these resources and time and lobbying invested into this and having formerly incarcerated people come and speak and talk about how they've turned their lives around and they've paid their public due to society and this shouldn't follow them. Yet, if someone just performed a simple Google search of their name, everything that this law worked for is just undercut because the same perception is still there.
Talking to Tunde Ahmad, a Columbia Journalism Review Delacorte Fellow. He wrote a piece for the review called Why Journalists Need to Think Twice About Reporting on Arrests. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. Do you think the media over reports on crime? And do they put it too front and center on the newspaper? If you look at a physical newspaper, on the website, on the newscast, do you find it useful to hear reports of crime and arrests in your community? Would you like to see it done differently? Have you or someone you know been affected by a crime report that maybe you didn't end up being charged with, but that initial newspaper article, it's still out there for maybe an employer to Google? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Tunde Ahmad, a Columbia Journalism Review Fellow. We're talking about how journalists report on arrests and how it can impact the lives of those involved and contribute to perceptions that there's more crime than there really is. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think there's too much reporting on crime in your go-to media sources? Is it overstated, over-dramatized, or do you think it's appropriate what you see out there? Are there changes you'd like to see? Should we see the names of people when they're initially charged in the media before they are convicted? Call 800-642-1234. And if somebody is cleared of a crime, should those old news articles be removed from archives? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Today we heard from Andy in Madison who says, overcovering crime in our neighborhoods turns my wife into a helicopter parent. She gets nervous about things she shouldn't be nervous about. Do you think there's something to that, if we're seeing lots of crime coverage, maybe disproportionate amounts, it affects our daily lives?
I definitely think this is the case. I mean, the statistics show that for the past 40 years, crime has actually been on a steady decline. However, perceptions are that crime is on the rise. And I think, I mean, people are receiving so much information from so many places, but when it comes to crime, majority of that is coming from news media and news media outlets. And I think that those two things are directly correlated. For so long, these outlets have been operating on the principle of if it bleeds, it leads. Instead of, you know, reporting on a larger array of daily news that still occurs. And I think for crime, of course, it's often the breaking news because those are the things that historically have attracted people's attention. But a lot of times, I think stories are just overcovering these things in a manner that they don't have to be.
And something I've noticed long term is, okay, if you've got a new crime to cover every day, that can be in the paper. And if you don't have a new crime, you can have charges filed in the old crime, exonerations or arrests made in the old crime, conviction in the old crime. So it can inflate to fill up whatever news space you have.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that there are just so many other things to cover. I mean, there's so many things going on with education, with politics, with sports and local sports. And I think we can expand to fill up more of the space with that. I'm not saying everything we report has to be positive, but I think things should be a reflection of society. And so crime is a portion that I think we shouldn't do away with crime reporting altogether, But I think there are so many other topics that are worthy of our attention, that are worthy of informing the public on, but we just don't see that. And this revolving door of the news cycle just consistently goes into crime. I'd say, go ahead.
Oh, no, that's okay. Go for it.
I was going to say, I mean, just to like put things into perspective, we gave the example of Darnell and Darcell Trotter and how they were falsely convicted of something, exonerated, but these articles still exist today. But like, this is literally something that could happen to anyone. I'm saying today, if you're on your way home from work, and let's just say you're waiting on the bus or something, and someone comes up to you and tries to rob you, and you defend yourself. However, police come at the moment that you're defending yourself. You may get charged with assault because they don't know how the incident started. But let's say, lucky for you, the camera was there was a camera running that was surveillance footage. So the police go back to that. They see what happened. And they drop all charges a week or so later after everything is processed. However, the local news media who hears about this brawl and maybe someone got it on camera or something, and there's a video to go along with it, and now you have this article about you being charged with assault. But in reality, that article doesn't reflect what actually went down in that situation. And while in a legal court, you were cleared of this, you're exonerated of this, there's also what a lot of people refer to as the court of media or the court of news cycle of social media, because your perception is still has value outside of a court of law. You know, if anyone Googles you for employment, if you're even, you know, in the scene of dating or something and someone just, you know, you meet someone and they Google you and that's what they find out, it can lead them down a false road or something that isn't really a reflection of events that occurred or the type of person that you are.
Talking to Akintunde Ahmad with the Columbia Journalism Review about a piece he wrote on crime reporting, over-reporting maybe of crimes, and the impact it can have of reporting on every stage of the crime, including maybe an initial arrest of someone who's eventually exonerated, the impact that can have on people's lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tunde, you wrote this at a thing that a lot of journalists read. What kind of response have you gotten from maybe reporters and others in the news business?
So I'm a recent journalism school grad myself. I actually graduated in the spring of this year from Columbia Journalism School. And so a lot of my fellow classmates have accepted entry-level roles a lot of times in metro reporting, in breaking news reporting. And I've received text messages by the tens, by the 20s of them who have read this and have said, like, I've only been on this job now for 3 or 4 months, but I'm so happy you wrote this piece, and I'm sending it to my editors because they're consistently sending me out to report on these crimes. And every time I get a name, a charge, a very brief, vague description of what happened, because nobody there was actually, I mean, because no one who was actually witnessed it was there to tell me what happened. I'm just getting the police report account. And they're like, I do this over and over, and A, I don't feel like it adds any value to my job and my development as a journalist, but B, more often than not, it doesn't actually add any value to the public being educated about what's going on, because it's petty crime here, you know, a petty theft thing, or you said a drunken nightclub fight somewhere, or just something very minuscule. And I will reiterate, I think that if something does pose a significant threat to society, by all means, there should be a piece written about it, especially if someone is still at large and they're searching for them. I am for publishing people's names if there's significant evidence to link someone to this and it can be solved and or at least helped out the public with being more safe, then by all means we should do that. But oftentimes it's not, and my classmates have really overwhelmingly reached out after reading this, and I didn't even expect that many people to have this viewpoint, because I had never worked on breaking news myself. But all of the reporters that I interviewed and just their feedback has been like, this is really a problem that we're trying to find a way to address it. And I think some newsrooms right now are working on this. There isn't any widespread, I guess, law or widespread practice amongst newsrooms to practice the right to be forgotten. But some newsrooms are proposing this and implementing that, a system where people can go on their website, fill out a form, talk about the date and the title of the piece that they were mentioned in and provide some sort of reasoning, whether it be documentation or just, a personal reason why this is A, no longer of value to the public, B, how it's harmed them, and the reason why it should be taken down. And
I want to bring in a call or two maybe before we run out of time. Al is with us near Dodgeville. Al, hi.
Hi. I just had a couple of comments. I know that I don't watch a lot of TV news coverage, but I know when I do, typically they spend the last couple of minutes, maybe 5 minutes, profiling someone or something positive that happened in the world today, either local or national. And I think to myself, I'd like to watch 30 minutes of that type of news coverage as opposed to the 25 minutes of negative news coverage preceding the 5 minutes of something positive. I don't think there's much value at all in seeing some of the coverage of crime in the media on television.
And since we're a little short on time, Al, I'll stop you at that one point. Tunde, you said it doesn't have to all be positive, but do you agree with Al that the crime coverage is maybe taking some of the real estate away from maybe other kinds of stuff?
Oh, 100%. 100%. I advocate for a newsroom that is balanced. And I think there is so much positive news that gets overlooked and not covered because folks are so focused on reporting on crime that I think it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. People have reported on crime for so long, so that's what people are used to seeing. And subsequently, newsrooms think that that's what people want to see, but they haven't tried out a news cycle where they report on more positive things going on in the community, upcoming elections and local elections. Like, there are such a wide array of things. And I think when crime is important and poses a public safety issue, then definitely report on it. But more often than not, this is not something that is going to be in your daily news, always apparent news cycle. And however, we said it's been declining for the past 40 years, but the perception is that it's been increasing, and that's directly linked to how often we focus on crimes. And it really does not have to be that way. There's so many more things out there that need to be reported that are just as important, in my opinion, more important than this, but it's still that way. So I hope that some editors, some chief editors can hear this and maybe implement some changes into their newsrooms.
Al, thanks for the call. Tunde, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. And thank you, Al, for the call as well.
That's Akintunde Ahmad with the Columbia Journalism Review. He wrote a piece, Why Journalists Need to Think Twice About Reporting on Arrests. Up Monday on Central Time, scientists keep finding more planets outside of our solar system. Some of them are really weird by Earthling standards. We'll explore the wild world of extrasolar planets. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.